reaction to the Newtonian science. Man as machine, Newton's concept of man as machine came to be thought of as man as machine, that and nothing else. Man is only a machine, which served the Enlightenment view of man and the elevation of reason unreasonably. Reason was seen as the only source of knowledge, and man was reduced to an irrelevant spectator. And of course, man doesn't, as we said last time we met, man, the times are very hard to operate that way, to think that way. And so there was a reaction based not on reason, but on feeling. And in defiance of reason, I put it in the syllabus, this excerpt from Woodsworth's "The Tables Turn." Our meddling intellect, he says, causes us to misunderstand. And what do we go on? We go on feeling. And there was a great revival of, there was a great, much like today, there was a reaction to that, and there was a turn to experience. And it's this old cultural phenomena that when people feel like the external world has betrayed them, then they turn to the internal world, the objective to the subjective. And men felt like that God had left them objectively, that religion based upon objective data was no longer viable, that is, based on revelation of the Bible. So there turned to, there was a great turning inward, the inward experience at all quarters. And sentiment began to reign in poetry and literature. The important thing was, how do we feel? The instinct, intuition. And corresponding to the romantic movement in literature, there was experiential movements in religion, Pietism and Methodism. In Germany, and this is a review, we studied this in the history of Protestantism, Spener and Frank led the movement in German Pietism, which was not based on the Bible, which is a little bit, the Bible was not left out, either, but it was based on the experience. And in England, the Methodist movement, and in America, the camp meetings and the revivalism, all of which is bad, of course, but this approach constituted, it must be understood in its largest possible context, which was this reaction to the Newtonian mechanical view of the universe, a reaction against reason, and it produced theology, not only a literature that was a reaction against reason, it produced religious movements that were in their essence reactions against religion, so against reason. And you find that kind of thing. The Methodist revivalists on the frontier, for instance, were known for to them, a meeting never was, your time was wasted. People didn't get excited. I've been reading the book that Daryl is lonely, Peter Cartwright's book on the Baptist preacher, Baptist church back preacher. He went and preached, and if there was no excitement, as he called it, then he figured the Lord had, something was wrong, the Lord hadn't been present. By excitement, he meant fainting or shouting or snotting blowing around. You know, everybody had, it's this old thing, you know, you haven't had church, most people cry, or shout, or jump a pew, or fall down, or get a little bit excited. And that is a very dangerous approach. But religion has always had this. I think we had in the early, the late 1950s, the present time, we've seen this problem in America, a reaction against reason, an emphasis on action, feeling, intuition, the inner light burning in the bosom, as the Mormons say. And so that a man can say, well, I don't care what the facts are, I don't care what the data, what the science say, I don't care. God and I have an experience of God, and that's good. Well, what happens in this is that in the short run, listen to me, in the short run, religion seems to be helped. But what always proves true in the long run, biblical Christianity suffers. And you see a leftover of this, you see a vestige of this in our religious culture today, and we're getting over this in some quarters, but there is there came into the American Protestant tradition, especially in the Wesleyan Methodist Aquinas churches, and later on, going out of that at the turn of the century, the Pentecostal churches, especially in many of the Baptist churches already, they're getting out of that. The old churches of God, and in our churches, there has been, in many cases, some places, a reaction against learning, a reaction against reason, a suspicion of learning. Our preacher, I felt telling you one time, a Pentecostal preacher, quite proudly, that our preachers are not, our preachers are called, they aren't hatched. We don't get our training from books, we get our training from the Spirit. He was half right. He sure got none of the books. But there is some of this strain which is still in our American Protestant thought, and that is a suspicion of reason, and it's in my music still, and it's freedom for the most part. But the part of it, again, the part of this reaction is romantic movement's reaction against reason. So that G.K. Chesterton is a good author to read. You ever read G.K. Chesterton? Book. And he wrote a series of detective stories called The Father Brown. It's called Father Brown. It was a priest. He was an amateur detective. Every day, reasoning powers. I thought it was Dupin, Poe's Dupin, and Doyle's Sherlock Holmes, and detectives. Anyway, Chesterton, he was a Roman Catholic, conservative Roman Catholic. Chesterton would make all kinds of theological points in his fiction. There was an attempt to make it a TV series some time back. In fact, there was one or two made on the ground. Didn't fly, yes, the pilot. But anyway, Father Brown is this logician. In one of the stories, these are all short stories, by the way, you don't have to read them all. I imagine even that McManus would get good before he fell asleep. In one of the stories called the Blue Cross, or I can't say, I don't know where it's the Blue. Anyway, Father Brown is carrying with him his nemesis, just like the Moriarty was the great antagonist of Sherlock Holmes. You've heard of him, haven't you? Most of you heard of him. Just as his nemesis, the nemesis of Sherlock Holmes, was Professor of Evil Genius, Professor Moriarty, while the nemesis of Father Brown in his escapades was the great French celebrated criminal Valentine, Valentine, I call him. And he was he was not a murderer. He was a sportsman to the end. But he was always running afoul of Father Brown. That's his way. Anyway, and so Father Brown is on his way to the meeting church, and he's got a very valuable antique cross, bejeweled cross that he's carrying. And he's trying to get it to where it's supposed to go, and Valentine, the master of disguise, is trying to steal the thing. I'll keep this up if you guys will start reading books. he's going to steal the thing, and so he's trying, so there's one mind, you know, you got this little, and but Valentine hasn't met Father Brown yet. Father Brown's a dumpy little fella, nearsighted, and always dropping things, I think it's a prototype for Columbo. I can't prove that, but I think that's where the idea came from. Columbo always looks like he just can't quite get anything together. His shoes aren't, you know, his suit is unpressed and his shoes are not polished. He just keeps forgetting. Never can find anything. one of the ways that Columbo. That's one of my favorite shows on television. I watch it every chance I get. One of the few that if you ever go to Columbo's, you never seen him with a gun. You never shot anybody. He never puts handcuffs on people and he arrests them. Anyway, very non-violent, right? And so, Columbo always gets, part of the story, he gets an advantage on the people he knows guilty because they think he's stupid. Well, Father Brown's like that. You know, they think he's just one of these little country, back country priests, you know, who's nearsighted and afraid. Well, anyway, and so Valentine doesn't know that yet. He's going to steal the cross from this priest, and the priest outwits him. And Valentine disguised himself as a priest. He tries to get next to, as the story goes, he tries to get next to the priest. And he's been following him. And it later dawns on that the priest, he comes out that the priest had him figured out all along and was one step ahead of him. I'll tell you the story yourself. Father Brown stays one step ahead of him all the way. But anyway, my point, which I can't seem to get to since it's Friday, is that Valentine tries to act like a priest this is his disguise again, and he tries to, in his brilliant thief, he gets into a discussion of theology with Father Brown about, and he attacks reason, which is why I brought all this up. he attacks reason, and he's in this theological debate. And Father Brown defends reason. This is Chesterton, you see, he's bringing out this point. Father Brown defends reason, and Valentine says, well, who knows, but what beyond the stars, there's a reality beyond our reason. Father Brown says, oh, no. Reason reigns everywhere. So we in the church are often accused of attacking reason. We alone hold for reason. We alone hold the reason. Well, anyway, after Valentine finds out he's been had, he asks, well, how did you see through my disguise, Valentine? He's a sportsman. This was just before he's arrested. He asks Father Brown tells him how he figured him out, how he got the place. He pulled the old switcheroo and he saved the valuable antique cross. And so again, Valentine just can't believe it. This priest, stupid little priest, outwitted him. So finally, Father Brown says, oh yes. Like Columbus just about to go out the door. He says, oh yeah. He said, oh yes, there's one more thing. He said, told me you weren't a priest. Well, he says, if you attack reason, it's bad theology. Well, Chesterton is writing in this setting, the Romantic movement, need to follow. You attack reason. It's bad theology. But you see, to attack reason by many was considered to be good theology by the German pietistic movement, by the Wesleyan Whitefield Methodist movement in England, by the same kind of movements in America, and it's still around. So what I want us to see, that this kind of theology was in part an aspect, not in entirety, but in part it was an aspect of this romantic, by that I mean sentimental, intuitive, not simply non-rational, but anti-rational reaction to this idea, to the idea that somehow Newtonian physics, the Newtonian model, the Newtonian paradigm, put reason in and God out. You understand? Not that it logically did that, but that it was conceived of doing that. And that was Chesterton's point. He has Father Brown saying, oh no. See, in other words, Valentine, who was a Frenchman, and an agnostic, an infidel, an atheist, he was speaking as he was the Enlightenment mind. Now, Chesterton doesn't explain all this. You don't know this from the outside. But he represents the Enlightenment. And he thinks he's going to really get in good with this priest by attacking reason. And Father Brown says him straight. Oh, no. That's bad theology. We alone preserve reason. And it's you guys. And it's true, you see. Because the idea that in the Newtonian paradigm, in the Newtonian model, that reason replaced God, that in itself was unreasonable, which is Father Brown's point. That is the destruction of reason, the abandonment of reason. Is that interesting to you? I learned how to read from the wide point of view. So anyway, back to my point. What were the philosophical responses? Well, David Hume, the man who is credited with killing the idea of miracles. I'll list you the precursors to Hume. Descartes, Leibniz, Spinoza in the 17th century had been impressed by the rational, theoretical, mathematical side of early physics. True knowledge exists in the mind's grasp of innate ideas. Mathematics was self-evident, that is, deductible without any necessary resort to particular observations. The idea that man, that knowledge is innate. Bacon, on the other hand, stressed the observational side of science. Locke, the systematic foundation of empiricism he held for, inspired by Newtonian science. He was opposed to innate ideas. Locke thought of the mind as a tabula rasa. You know what that is? Blank tabula. It's blank. On which the senses write. Ideas are empirical in origin, build up from data furnished by the five senses. The mind creates forms and symbols and does not start with them. That is, with Descartes and Leibniz and Spinoza, the mind has built into it innate ideas. Locke denied that. But what's going on now? Men are examining reason. You see that? They're examining what they're doing is they're focusing their microscopes, as it were, or so to speak, on the human mind, on reason. How does reason, what are the limits of reason? What is the character of reason? Locke's treatise on human understanding, which we read, I think, in Restoration History. Treatise on human understanding. You get that? He is applying reason to reason itself. And all these men are coming to different conclusions. But they're examining the character of reason. Character of how does the human mind work? So that's what's going on. Hume said the only reliable human knowledge is based on sense impressions that are discrete, fleeting, and fragmentary. Ideas are memory images of these perceptions, and the validity must be tested by tracing them back to the sense data from which they arose. Therefore, any idea not derived from the senses is meaningless. That is, you cannot, by the nature of thought means how shall I put it? With Hume, the nature of thought points to the unreliability of the objective. That you cannot really know a thing in itself. It sounds like Plato, doesn't it? You cannot really know a thing in itself. All you have are fleeting impressions of a thing. And they're always changing, moving on. All knowledge is atomistic, according to Hume. That is, you know things in bits and pieces. You can't really know a thing because as soon as you've known it, time passes and it's different, and your knowledge of it is different, your perception is different. Seeming connections between cause and effect are only repeated temporal successions of sense impressions. The laws of nature, therefore, are only probable expectations based on previous experience. That is, it was an elevation of the subjective against the objective. Therefore, he said, we cannot know God as first cause. See, Newton held on to that, didn't he? Newton reserved that. Hume denied that much of it. He said, we can't know God as first cause. Why? Because we didn't see him. Since cause cannot be inferred from effect alone, the idea of God and the miracles is empty speculation. Hume argued for an infinite series of events in a self-sufficient universe rather than an uncaused first cause. That is, what he did is, he simply says, he attacks the validity of epistemology. By the way, Hume's thought isn't worth a nickel. I'm just going to pay that. What Hume did was, by emphasizing the fact that human thought processes, the human mechanism of knowing, because it is hard to pin down and because it is so complicated, Hume made a philosophy out of that. I'm sort of summarizing for you, I understand. And therefore, and this was the importance of Hume. Hume undercut the integrity of all knowledge. What many people did not notice, see, Hume said that when you examine the human mind, are y'all tuned in? I know it's Friday, this is abstract, this is the hardest of it to teach, because this stuff is so, its abstractness is exceeded only by its meaninglessness. It's really stupid. Explain this, but I. One thing you learn about philosophy is that 9/10 of your job in philosophy is learning what they mean by the language, breaking the code. Once you break the code, you're not the ideas themselves, not going to take one to the other. But anyway, in this, you guys have noticed that Leibniz and Locke, not taking different views, but what they're doing, as I said before, they're looking at how the mind, in other words, what they're saying is, you cannot. They're trying to go beneath. Well, you don't want to go out beneath today. Yeah, let's try. Now here I'm overlapping with Dean Chambers, and so any contradictions or inconsistencies between what I teach and what he teaches, you know that he's wrong. I'm sure he does much better. This is his area. He's a philosopher. Here's what's going on, you guys. You ready? You see, the big question in what he's saying is that before we raise the question of what we know, we have to look at the question of how do we know? Because what we know depends on how we know it. And whereas Spinoza, for instance, was saying we have this innate, we're born with knowledge, and all we have to do is get it organized and draw proper deductions, that's sort of the old Platonic idea you're simply not learning, education is simply exposing and organizing, bringing to the surface ideas which are implanted in man somehow. Uh, box said no, man's born a blank page, a blank tablet, slate, and everything comes to the five senses. Hume said that what we know, we can't know anything for sure, because we can't nail down how we know. It's all fleeting perception, it's all atomistic, it's bits and pieces. Therefore, we cannot know God as first cause. We see everything piecemeal. So what Hume is saying is that the Christian faith, hear me, the Christian faith is unthinkable, because the Christian faith represents, now listen to me, the Christian faith represents objective conclusions about God, and that kind of objective conclusion cannot be drawn because of the uncertain processes by which we know anything. Therefore, it is impossible to know that there is a God. It's impossible to believe in miracles. It's impossible to have a faith based on history, based on what happened, because we can't really know what happened. Now, and everybody thought, well, isn't that great? When Hume got to put it, it sounded very intellectual. Everybody thought that's great fun. Remember, that's so much for miracles. Hume has killed miracles. What many of them didn't notice, because they didn't want to notice, that if you take Hume's epistemology, or his anti-epistemology, I guess you know, I would call it, that it destroys science just like it destroys Christianity. That if you cannot have objective certainty about God and miracles, the mind is also incapable of having objective certainty about anything, including science. That is, what was pointed out later, but what the enthusiasts of the day did not seem to notice, was that Hume not only destroyed religion, he destroyed science as well, because he destroyed knowledge. That is, Hume removed the integrity of knowledge. Well, once you do that, you cannot be selective about it. You cannot say, well, yes, but Hume, following Hume, we have no knowledge of God, but we have a knowledge of the universe. Put it another way, in the process, Hume set out to destroy religious knowledge, and lo and behold, he destroyed what we would loosely call scientific knowledge the same way, at the same time. So Hume just put everybody in never, never land. Let's return to our syllabus. He attacked the argument from design, which was a common argument. It's still a good move. It is a good move. He argued the universe is less like a clock, that's Newton, than a plant, the life force within. A finite world containing only relative good can only imply a finite God of relative goodness with finite power. That is, what he said is that you cannot argue from design because there's too much in the world that's evil. And that just shows superficial knowledge of things, but Hume, got that? Hume said, because you cannot use the argument from the teleological argument, because there is so much in the world that doesn't look the way we think it would look if there were a God. Therefore, you cannot argue from God as first cause. He rejected the Enlightenment's confidence in the power of reason. You see, so just as the sentimentalist, listen to me, just as Wordsworth, the sentimentalist, rebelled against reason, and the religionists, like Wesley and Whitefield, rebelled against reason, so the philosopher rebelled against reason from a different direction, or reason is having a hard time with it. He was skeptical of the possibility of demonstrable knowledge of the laws of nature. Now, but you see, while it may seem like philosophical fun to destroy the integrity of knowledge, Hume admitted that he had to drop his unmitigated skepticism. Why? Because if you sit in your armchair and theorize and have, and, you know, this kind of thing is often a favorite indoor sport, but you can't live that way. he was not atheistic, he was agnostic, but the difference between agnosticism and atheism is the difference between truly being and truly dumb. Agnosticism is more, in my opinion, is more intellectually feeble position. But they ain't gonna get into that. Hume's extreme empiricism undermined deism and natural theology as well. That is, by extreme empiricism, I mean, he says, the only thing you can know, the question is, how do you know, therefore what do you know? Hume said, I'm trying to simplify this, Hume said, because the method of knowing is so atomistic and temporal and fleeting and changing and uncertain. Therefore, all we can know for sure is what we, well, he said, we can't know anything for sure. The closest that we can come to ever knowing anything for sure is what we can see and touch right now, sort of. What we can immediately observe and feel through our senses, but we can't be too sure of that. What he says is we don't ever know, Hume would say this, that I can't ever know Joe Caputo. I can't ever say that I know him. All I can spend a lot of time with him, still not knowing him. I can talk to him, I can write his life history and not know him. All I don't have in my mind a knowledge of Joe Caputo. All I have is a series of impressions. That is, he would not talk about, therefore I cannot talk about Joe Caputo. All I can talk about is my perceptions of Joe Caputo. And since all I can talk about are my perceptions of the fellow, then I have no objective knowledge about him. Therefore, I can't even be sure he exists. I might be fooled, theoretically. And my knowledge of him, therefore, is so defective. Understand? I don't have Joe. I don't have knowledge of Joe. All I have is knowledge of my knowledge. An awareness of my perceptions of the fellow. Therefore, I can say nothing about him that is reliable. And so it applies to God. Can man know that there's a God? Can we know that Jesus lived and there were miracles? No. All we have is our perceptions, our atomistic, unreliable, fleeting, defective sense impressions of God from whatever source. Therefore, we can talk about our perceptions of God, the weak and the supernatural in any shape or form, but we cannot speak with reliability. We cannot speak with integrity about the thing itself at all. Unmitigated skepticism. Now, Hume was considered a great scholar. Hume, in my opinion, wasn't too bright. He was intelligent, you see, as I've said before. I did not accept the proposition that the man is educated, but just learned a whole lot was not true. And that kind of, you see, that kind of thinking is really sophomoric. And what I'm trying to say to you is the fact that Hume was considered to be a great scholar. Now, Hume earned accolades in other areas. But as far as his philosophy is concerned, listen more closely, the fact that he would be taken seriously shows the spirit of the age. And it shows the vacuity of unbelief. That is, it shows. Remember what I said before? The man who stops believing in God doesn't start believing in nothing, he starts believing in anything. And, you see, when you move to what I consider to be the non-rational view of the universe, which is the non-theistic view, then thin ideas come to be taken more seriously than they should be. That is, weak thinking tends to be regarded as being more subject than it is because the alternative is nothing. I'm simply saying that it's significant that Hume would be important. Because if you really want to get technical about it, if Hume is right, then we cannot know that Hume is right. For sure. Did you see my point? Because actually, you see, Mark, I don't really know what Hume said. All I can talk about is my perceptions of what Hume said. In fact, I'm not sure he existed. I can't really be sure he existed. Because we can be so easily fooled. And our perceptions are so defective and infected with subject emotions and error. In fact, I'm not even sure you're there. I recall, I was a freshman, we had a guy teaching philosophy. Seminary, when I was in there. He was seminary prior. About the time I left, I should have gone to the got to the University of Cincinnati. It's a grand liberal, it's a liberal vision. And he's now, by the way, on the trustees of the European Manchester Society. But he thought it was cute. He was like some of these undergraduate professors you find in philosophy at universities. He thought it was cute to confuse freshmen. It's very easy to do. It's easy to confuse seniors. But anyway. And we had this guy named Joe Ferguson, who was a real brain witness in a common sense coming out of brain. And he bought into this. He thought it was really cute. He thought skepticism, this is the finest university comes to all, and skepticism becomes stylish, to doubt. That is, they picked up on this idea, which is a sophomoric nonsense, that doubt is the same thing as intellect. That is, that to doubt is to be intellectual, is to be perceptive in and of itself. You know, to question. The great thing is not to find new answers, but to seek new things. So it became very strange. We had another fellow who was a freshman, who was a waiter. He had a good mind, but he is a new convert. And anyway, at the time, he was quite emotional. Now we call him one of these, what they call the bull sessions, and in the coach house. And his coach was sitting around. And Joe proceeded to tell this other fellow that he couldn't be sure about the Christian faith. And he used, Hume's, this little sort of uninformed version of Hume. He thought he was an intellectual. He heard a friend this kind of intellectual. And he said, why? He said, you can't even prove that I'm here. You can't really know. And so you can't even be sure that Coke bottle is real. He said, well, we'll just test it. He was going to hit the guy. And Joe got up and ran. Well, real. Look at the last point of my syllabus on the Hume. He said, you couldn't live this way. Why? Because, you see, it was all fine to be an intellectual exercise. You couldn't be sure. In other words, Joe thought he was being intellectual and saying, you really can't be sure the Coke bottle is there. But as a matter of fact, he was sure the Coke bottle was there. Got that? He was sure. It's like the Christian Scientist, he doesn't believe that drinking poison can really kill you, but they try to make you drink it and see what happens, because they really do, But it shows how far you can get from reality. Well, you all see the point about me now. This is my history of philosophy class. Then we come to Immanuel Kant. Kant agreed with Hume that sense data is the only source of knowledge, that is, knowledge that what you know from within your head, but he argued that the mind contains the innate ability to organize a structure of consciousness and thus interprets the data in terms of its own forms of understanding. That is, that the mind can impose categories and form on ideas, and therefore we can be sure, more sure than Hume said. He said space and time, therefore, are reliable categories. The mind takes the data that it brings in and has this ability to organize them into categories like space and time. Knowledge, therefore, is a joint product of sensory material and the innate structure of consciousness. Got that? That is, whereas Hume would say, the mind, knowledge is only sense material trouble within my concept is both. Causality is a category of understanding the mind brings to the sense data, or the language is derived from. You see, you said that the idea of cause and effect was just was something that existed in the mind, didn't necessarily exist out there. Therefore, you couldn't be sure if God is first cause. Now, no, said Kant. The mind, cause and effect is a category of understanding, and therefore, the idea that every effect has sufficient cause is not an empirical observation, but an indispensable presupposition of human thought. So an innate reality, can't deny. Causality is a general form by means of which the mind unifies the chaos of the atomistic data. Man's mind provides the general categories for interpreting relationships and our impressions. That is, what Kant is trying to do here is to preserve this fashionable skepticism, but be more common sense about it. As a matter of fact, what he's saying is that the mind has the innate ability to take objective data and organize into reliable categories. Therefore, we can be sure about something. But notice the certainty comes not from the nature of the objective data, but the certainty comes from the innate ability of the mind to organize knowledge into reliable categories. Kant denied the validity of the argument for causality, since it's only a subjective category. So it didn't move very far away from Hume, did it? That is, the idea of God as first cause and effect, he said it's a human, the mind imposes that category, therefore you can be objectively sure about it. The concept of cause can be applied only within temporal series. It cannot be applied to the whole series back to first cause. Hence, the existence of God can neither be proved nor disproved in and by human knowledge. What I'm saying is, Hume said, we cannot know enough to know there's a God. And Kant says, we can know more than Hume says we can, but we still can't know enough to know there's a God. We can't impose this. We can't impose the idea of cause and effect back too far. What he's saying is, if I push this table over, we can know that the cause is the effort, the pressure up and on, the effect is the destruction of this piece of equipment. But you can say you can know that very well. I'm pretty sure of that. You can do it and see it. But it's going too far to oppose cause and effect all the time. Why? Because the idea, this is what Kant says, the idea that the kind of action of I can push this over and cause and effect, the idea that that can be extrapolated back to God is simply a category of the human mind. The human mind putting things in categories very subjectively and they all an illusion. Again, what's the difference in Kant and Hume as far as certainty is concerned? No real difference. Could they be, could they come? But again, they're examining how man knows. The starting point of religion is therefore man's sense of moral obligation. Just like man can categorize things in space and time and cause and effect as a category, so moral obligation. Here you find people don't want to live without a sense of moral obligation. Remember I told you before, if you construct a world where there is no moral obligation, nobody's safe. You cannot live in a world where there is no moral obligation. It does not work. Nobody wants to live in it. So, moral obligation is sort of, where does it come from? Man sort of knows that. Ethics, not theoretical problems of metaphysics. Man experiences value as well as fact. He asks what is, but he also asks what ought to be. Kant argued for rationally justifiable universal human obligations to do the right. Why must men do the right? Because they know they ought to. Not because the Bible says so, not because there's a God, not because you can prove objectively that men ought to do the right. Men ought to do the right because they know they ought to do the right. By the way, in logic, this is called a tautology. What's a tautology in logic? The argument sort of this is from the Greek, tautos is the Greek word for this. Tautos, tautology, this is this. You follow me? I am because I am. Tautology. It is because it is. So why does man have moral obligation? Because he knows he has a moral obligation. How does he know he has a moral obligation? Because he knows he has a moral obligation. You see, with Hume, realize, what other people realize that if you try to live in Hume's universe, you've got moral chaos. So the argument of teleology, what it is saying is that we know science, we know objectively, but, at least up to a point, religion is purely subjective. And we have borne the idea that religion, or at least expressed the idea, impetus given to the idea, that religious faith is one kind of thinking, and scientific knowledge is another kind of thinking. Therefore, science cannot refute religion because science is not the same category as religion. You might be having a cup of coffee while I teach this one day last night. I went to a meeting late last night and I'm tired. Did you feel sorry for me?
Yeah.
Awful how I said it. Don't bury my dog in the head of my the 18th century. Okay? I put these summaries in to kind of help me as much as you. Look at God and nature. The reductionist view of nature is a self-sufficient machine in which all future events are inexorably determined by the laws of matter and motion. God, the clockmaker of deism, was then omitted completely by the materialism of the French Enlightenment, and then the Romantic movement was a reaction holding for an underlying spiritual reality to nature that is very subjective. We saw its religious version, its philosophical version, and even Locke, human commons, and Locke, of a Locke. Come to methods in science, Hume denied the significance of any idea not traced to sense data, but which destroys science, of course. Kant maintained that man supplies crucial categories of interpretation, but that doesn't leave them a whole lot better off. Look at methods in theology. Revelation was attacked by the Enlightenment, defended by Pietism and Methodism, but primarily on sentimental grounds. Natural theology was undermined by Hume and Kant because they attacked reason. And moral and religious expanse, you have Pietism and religion and Kantian experientialism. And that was where it stood. Come to the 19th century. This period sees the expansion of physics in the following areas: theories about light, theories about electricity, theories about thermodynamics. Physics really comes into its own in the 19th century as a science, as a area of thought. Totally new concepts. One is interacting fields. In the 19th century, one area of science begins to be coordinated with another area of science, integrated. And another concept was emerged of statistical probabilities. Then you start extrapolating and saying, well, this process extrapolated forward or backward will tell us this about history or predict X about the future. Then you have to get into probabilities of that happening. Other probabilities. Chemistry, in its modern form, grew from its foundations in Dalton's atomic theory early in the century to Mendeleev's formulation of the periodic table and the rise of organic chemistry at its close. You ever take high school chemistry and have them on the wall, the table of organic compounds? That's of course, the one I had in high school is outdated now. There's so many more. But that was worked out, the basis of that, in early 19th century. What I'm saying is this, that modern chemistry as we know it was formulated in the 19th century, as we know it. The flourishing of practical technology based on the physical sciences. It was in the 19th century that men began to put theoretical knowledge to practical use. What do we get in the 19th? Well, we get the steam engine, the locomotive. And we get uses of electricity. And chemicals. Various chemicals are developed. The idea is, the genius of the, of course, he comes at the turn of the century, happens after this, but the man who most represents that spirit full grown, of course, is our man like Thomas Edison. He would take a scientist, but how can I create something that will make life easier? How do I make it work? The machines, the sewing machines, how do things begin to be developed? The development had the most profound impact on, oh, by the way, I got a good example of this, although somewhat later, is that Carousel of Progress out of the Magic Kingdom. These are the best days of our life. Well, you see, this, after it's exploded, the idea of General Electric, everything makes science, you put it to work. Well, that concept, what I'm saying, is a 19th century concept. The development that had the most profound impact on human thought, creating a major intellectual revolution, was a revolution in biology. Darwinism came to be accepted as a unifying principle. Now, it didn't become a jerky process by which it came to be. It was uneven. But we'll see that. Evolution as an interpretive, well, that's not what they say today. That's one of their favorite words, unifying principle. Evolution as an interpretive principle spread into literature, history, ethics, religion, what came to be called the social sciences, and others. No field of intellectual endeavor could tolerate being anything but evolutionist. It was the new thought. It was genuine revolution. When we studied, including theology. Everything must be explained in terms of gradual, natural evolution from the simple to the complex, from the primitive to the modern, from the low to the high. This period saw the rise of liberal critical scholarship, as we know. You see, before, the skepticism of the French Enlightenment, for example, was an emotional thing. You see a good, those of you who are studying Restoration History, we're studying Robert, we just finished studying Campbell Owen today. And here you have Robert Owen, who was a skeptic. But there was not a rational skepticism, it was an emotional skepticism. He tried to debate Campbell and lost his socks. Why? Because there was no cohesion to his thinking. And old French skepticism was based on, it's more emotional. That is, it was kind of a snotty rejection of religion without good reason for it. But you see, with the 19th century, it seemed to men now that skepticism had finally become scientific. It seemed to men. Skepticism was scientific. Okay, this brings us to one of the most critical things we'll study this quarter. Darwin and natural selection. Darwin and natural selection. The component elements I'm reading now of the theory of evolution had been proposed long before the publication of Origin of Species, 1859. Darwin's idea of natural selection as the mechanism of evolutionary change constituted the basis for the synthesis of theories of evolution. Darwin seemed to make evolution intellectually and scientifically respectable. with the concept of natural selection, which phrase, by the way, he did not coin. A fellow called Spencer coined that. He was a social scientist. If social scientists, if there was such a thing in that day. Okay. Now, we understand that notion. But evolution has been around for a long time. Now, let me just teach you something here. We'll talk about that. This is the place to learn it. That evolution was not born in the biology department. It was born in the philosophy department. And it is not, listen to me, evolution is not, and I'm just looking at it now from a perspective way. By that I mean looking at it, standing as, how shall I say this? You stand back from the subject of evolution versus Christianity, theism. You stand as far back from it as you can possibly get and take the most broad, panoramic view of it. What do you see? Here's what you see. It is not intellectually significant that the theory of evolution exists. It is inevitable. That does not make it true. In fact, it undercuts its credibility. Here's what I mean. If you start with, and just follow my reasoning in this, think with me, okay? If you start with the biblical, if the Bible, let's play it for a minute, let's deal with Platonic, okay, Aristotelian and deductive now, okay? Think with me. If man is what the Bible says he is, then we are not surprised to see man rejecting God as an act of the will. Romans 1, men do not want to have God in their knowledge. Not, you see, it is one thing for man to be driven away from a truth by the evidence. But remember I said that evolution started in the philosophy department, not biology? Why? See, men were not driven to the theory of evolution by evidence. Men chose the theory of evolution because it seemed to offer an alternative to God. Men do not want to have God in their knowledge. Now, if that's true, right? If that's true, that the biblical view of man is accurate, that men do not want to have God in their knowledge, then we would expect men to existentially choose not to have God in their knowledge, which is that what we find. In other words, men do not find God because, in other words, as I said today, men can't find God for the same reason that he can't, at least even look at it. Okay, now, if you move away from the idea of God, at least and the kind of God you read about in the Bible, then when you raise the inevitable question of origins, where did things come from, what do you have left but evolution in some form? Or to put it another way, if you reject the eternal God, then all you've got left is the eternal clod. If we're here, we're here, so that it is not intellectually significant that the theory of evolution exists, it is theologically inevitable. Therefore, its existence, whether it's true or false, its existence does not demonstrate intellectual advancement. It demonstrates moral degeneration. It's very existence, whether it's true or not. Now, did you get that? I mean, that is, it's like this. There's no saying in philosophy department, not philosophy, that there are only so many men in the room. You heard that? No, I saw what that means. No, I saw what that means. Yeah, those are so many alternatives. That is, there are not 20 alternatives to God. You're talking about origins. But creationism, right? In other words, if you reject creationism on philosophical grounds or on emotional grounds, spiritual grounds, you reject creationism, what is there left? You don't have 10 things to choose from. You don't have 2 things to choose from. All you've got is the concept that if God did not create the world, the only thing you've got left is some kind of creation through a natural, gradual process. Do you understand? That's my... So it is... And... But they're not... You've got nowhere else to go. Therefore, understanding that, we are not surprised that the theory of evolution existed long before modern science existed, long before geology was a science, long before biology was a science. By the Greeks, were evolutionists, many of them, in some shape. So evolution was around a long time before Darwin. Why? Well, it had to be. If men are going to reject God, and they do, what else are you going to do? And if you understand that, you've gone a long way toward understanding the character of modern theories of evolution. Why do they exist? Because they're intellectually defensible? No, because they must exist. They would exist no matter what. If the Bible is true about man, they would have to exist. And if it has to exist, that, by implication, does not support its intellectual credibility, its It's like a police officer. It's like a detective who walks into a room. And I'm just giving you an analogy of much, okay? He walks into a room and finds a corpse. And his job is to find out who done it. And like in the game of Clue, you know, you got Mrs. Mustard in the library, Colonel Mustard in the library with the range and whatever. Let's say that there are 7 suspects in the house, okay? And one of them is the butler, and one of them is the wife of the corpse, and the man was killed. Right? You got that? And he walks in, and they call in, you know, somebody discovers the body. He comes in, they call him, and he arrives. He walks in without any knowledge of the evidence, without any knowledge of the situation. He walks in, and he looks and says, the butler did it. Immediately. And he arrests the butler. Somebody says, well, how do you know the butler did it? He hadn't done it. Why? He just had to. I know he did it. I don't like the look of his eyes. He let me in the house. He looked suspicious. He did it. Well, maybe she did it. No, he did it. Well, maybe the brother-in-law, the worthless brother-in-law, he did it. No, the butler did it. How do you know? Well, I just know he did it. He had to do it. He's the guilty one. Where's your evidence? I don't need evidence. The butler did it. So he summons, though he has the, he charges the butler. He arrests the butler. And he leaves. Under investigation. Just arrest the butler. Never entertained any other possibility. Never investigated. He just assumed the butler did it. Why? Because he did, that's why. I don't want to hear more about it. The butler did it. Well, did the butler do it? Maybe he did. Did the butler do it? Would he win his case in court? Why? that his case would be thrown out of court. Why? He didn't entertain any other possibility. They would say to him, your charge, your conclusion, is it may be the right one, but we have no way of knowing if it's the right one. What I'm saying is that his case would be so weak that he'd be thrown out of court immediately. Because he entertained no other possibility. Whether evolution is true or false, his case is intrinsically weak. Because evolutionists tend to entertain no other possibility. And the reason they entertain no other possibility is the only other possibility is creation. You think I'm making that up? That's what they say in their books. So you go, remember I cited this, Special Problems College with Edmund Wilson, author of his manifesto, I quote him, G. Gerard Simpson, who says he's the godfather of evolutionists. He says, we simply will entertain no other possibility. We will look for a natural explanation, and we will not look for any other kind of explanation. So if a man says, Edmund Wilson said, oh, surely my good friend G. Gerard Simpson wouldn't have said something like that, because that'd be that narrow. I had to look at me. He did say it. So that whether it's true or false, the case is intrinsically weak because if you accept, you see, if an author says, a scientist says, I'm going to look for a naturalistic, purely naturalistic explanation for everything, and I will entertain the possibility, no other possibility. He says this. This is the only natural, non-supernatural explanation. Is the only possible explanation. If he says that going in, or if he operates that way without saying so, now listen to me. The fact that he does not come out at the end of the book with a conclusion of creation, divine creation, is simply meaningless. It is not significant. And many people think it is. Our high school kids think it is. They think it is significant when scientists can investigate origins, investigate the biological order, and not come out of creations. And what I'm saying is, if you understand the mindset, it is meaningless if they do not. In other words, the statement, well, all scientists are evolutionists, of course, is not true. Many scientists are, yes, but if you understand how most of them operate, taking them at their own statements, it is simply not significant that they are not creationists. Yes, it is not significant that they are not creationists. Why? Because they are entertaining the possibility. And their case is just true, yes.
If I can prove to you that Christ exists,
you can prove to me. So
if I can prove you got permission, you can prove me.
I ask comments to the question of time. What kind of evidence he would accept? Believe in the resurrection of Jesus. And he could have been there. He could have been there. He would accept. I said, well, then, of course, you're under the idiot. When you say you don't believe, it is intellectually meaningless. It is simply the affirmation of a prejudice. But it's true. Now, what I'm trying to teach you is this. Here's why I bring this up, of course, in apologetics. What I want us to see is that this basic character, here's my point, that all that's what I can teach you is. This is, of course, in the history and logic of science. This basic character of the argument, whether it's true or false, you understand, I'm talking about the basic character of the argument, the shape of the argument, is manifest in the history of the argument. Evolution was accepted long before Darwin by skeptics. They did not arrive at it inductively. They were not driven to it by the evidence. It was a philosophical assumption. And the only possible philosophical assumption. It was like they decided that Butler did it, or they decided God did it. And it was not founded Listen to me, it was not founded on objective evidence, but upon a subjective desire to get away from God. And it has never been sustained by it. And that was what it began with. I want to see what Darwin did and did not do. I've made him a long time. We're going to see that many, you don't already know it, but many of the leading evolutionists in the world in the past 10 years have failed at evolution. Why? Well, I have maintained all along that evolutionists by the thousands would no longer be evolutionists if they had somewhere to go besides Genesis. They had somewhere to go besides traditional theism. They would bail out in a minute. And the tricks they have to play to stay in the game are absurd in many cases. Things you have to believe. You understand? That they would, any other field of science, they would have been, if evolution or any other field of science based on the credibility of the evidence, it would have been abandoned a long time ago. But there's nowhere else to go. There's only so many men in the room. And it started that way. It started as a philosophical prejudice by sinful man. It has been sustained by that, and this is today. But you see that as history, that's the part you see. That what we see in the history of evolutionary thought is inevitable. It had to happen. Utterly inevitable. What did Darwin do then? Why is Darwin the big name, the big honcho? Because Darwin, and it's very simple, and you should know this already, I'm probably reteaching something you already know, but Darwin offered what seemed to be an intellectually respectable, quote, scientific explanation how what many knew had happened did happen. He offered what seemed to be a scientific mechanism. All of a sudden, he was like a breath of fresh water. All of a sudden, it's like this. We knew all along that it happened. Now we know how it happened. That was kind of the point where those who looked closely realized that he didn't answer anything, but it seemed to be. And the interesting thing is, Darwin then was accepted everywhere in the biology department. It's humorous, it's really weird. But you see, the philosophers, the religionists, the sociologists, the psychologists, the socioeconomics theorists, everybody accepted Darwin as a biologist. Why? Because, as a matter of fact, biologists know this, but Darwin explained absolutely nothing. Only he explained why certain forms survive and others didn't. Why? Because he had an effect without a cause. He survived with it, but not derived it. But, why did an idea that the defects of which the biologists saw, you said it was never accepted as a biology. Why did it become, in other words, that which was considered unprovable, why was that which was considered not provable by the biologists taken to be as proved by Freud, Father Martin, modern psychoanalysis? Why did Marx want to dedicate Das Kapital to Charles Darwin? Became the base of John Dewey, modern education, in the field of education, and what came to be the social sciences, and in philosophy, and in religion, the source theories, and every other field of intellectual endeavor. Darwin was considered to be gospel. The only agnostics were in the biology department, and it was supposed to be a theory of biology. Why? Well, I'm trying to answer that in the last few minutes. Because, as Huxley said, we desperately wanted it to be true so we could have our sexual freedom. Because it was already assumed to be true. Men were not driven there by the facts. All of a sudden, evolutionism could explode, agnosticism could explode in Western civilization because now we know how it happened. Now it is now scientific. Yeah. Well, the scientists, the modern biologists will tell you quite candidly that Darwin, his Origin of Species, said nothing about origins and nothing about species. Oh, that's a pretty good book. Origin of Species goes down in history along with Christian Science, Neo-Orthodoxy, and Great Nuts Cereal.
You may quote.
You all understand the connection. But Great Nuts Cereal is the greatest of nuts. Christian Science is the Christian of Science. Neo-Orthodoxy is the new Orthodox. And Origin of Species said nothing about either origin or species. I have to remember that. Well, that's the latest. I mean, that's a good sign, and that's up to date. What did Darwin say about evolution? Nothing. Many biologists at the time noticed that. But then how did it become gospel? And you got communism, and Freudian psychology, which has done so much damage to Christianity. Freud was wrong about almost everything. Marx was wrong. Nothing. Why did Freudism, I'm going to call it that, Freudian psychology, why doesn't it work? Why didn't Marxism work? Why do we have to go to the police state? Why is modern education floundering? Why are social systems crumbling? One of the reasons is they're based on Darwin, and they're wrong. That's why they don't work. They're reductionist. They're defective. They're wrong. Why do we get two wars? We get two wars because men were wrong about God. And I made my point. I'm trying to what do you think this did? So here came Darwin with his Origin of Species, which offered what I just taught you. Any questions?
Comments?
Too bad.
Sure, you can't answer this in 5 minutes, but what he wrote is Origin of Species, but it wasn't evolution. And, you know, in a nutshell, what was it?
What he showed was natural, was what came to be, he didn't use the phrase, it was natural selection. See, several years before this, he had taken a voyage to Australia, the Beagle, and he had noticed in the Galapagos Islands that certain animals, especially finches, had developed into certain patterns. And then on one island, the finches would tend to be of a certain color, a certain shape, be another island, the same finches tended to be under color patterns, and the beaks were shaped slightly different. And so he pointed to what he said is the food available on the island, the environment, forced the selection of various certain strains, isolated them, and selected them. So we got more than the finches were big man. And what we call that today microevolution, it's not evolution at all. It is simply the ability that God has put in animals and the little understood ability to adapt to a changing environment to certain things.
Selection,
if that is, that the environment, that the weather, the available food supply, competing animals, that kind of thing allowed some creatures to survive where they didn't. Tended to select certain ones. Now, as the biologist, the reason the biologists didn't accept Darwin, once they thought was that the initial fundamental of Nocardia was that they pointed out that all that he explained was after you had certain finches, why you might find one finches with one dominant plumage on one island and another on the other, he would tell you the finches. You'll see later it was the theory of the mutation So he couldn't explain where anything came from. And the reason that modern taxonomists point out that Darwin said nothing about origin, in other words, biologists have known all along he said nothing about origin of species. And a modern taxonomist point out that Darwin's concept of species is useless. The concept of species is doesn't work. It was pretty good for his day. Did that help you? Well, okay. Let's get back to our syllabus. You don't mind me taking just, I want us to help you. I think it's my job as your teacher to help you think this through from this reasonable ground up. See the thing as it is, the big picture. Okay, I'm not gonna need money. Now, Darwin's idea of natural selection as the mechanism of evolutionary change, I'm reading again now, repeating myself. Now, having said what I said, then you'll have a greater appreciation of this beautiful sentence. Darwin's idea of natural selection as the mechanism of evolutionary change constituted a basis for the synthesis of theories of evolution, so pre-existing theories. Darwin seemed to make evolution intellectually and scientifically respectable. That was the one he seemed to. Now, listen to the forerunners of Darwin. Charles Lyell's, I mispronounced his name, Principles of Geology, created the modern science of geology. That is, he talked about, he said the Earth shows stratification, presumably built up over time, so that he made the basic observation that that which therefore appears here is younger than that which is down here. There was the concept, is Lyell's contribution, and more complicated than that, but that's kind of what we're looking at. And Jean-Baptiste Lamarck, who's a Frenchman, as his name suggests, and his theory of the transmission of acquired modifications versus the belief in the stability of biological forms. This undercut the argument for God from design. Now, hear me teach you about Lamarck, and this is a little quick for today, but you go for the weekend. Lamarck precedes Darwin. You must know that. Lamarck was a Frenchman, and he was attacking the idea, he's part of the Enlightenment, you know, that old shtick. And he was attacking the idea, he'd seen the very powerful argument for design. Why? And he was saying that the biological forms, the animals, for example, do not have the form that they have because they were designed that way by God. They just, nature designed them. How? And the key to Lamarckianism is the transmission of acquired characteristics. You all know that. You all understand that? That is, that a creature, a man, an animal, or a plant can, in reaction to and interacting with its environment, acquire a characteristic. And once it has acquired that characteristic, somehow this changes the cells in the body, the elements in the body, so that this characteristic is passed on to its offspring. And his classical, as you know, this classical illustration, example, sorry, was what? A giraffe. Lamarck loved a giraffe. Why? How did the giraffe get its long neck? Obviously there was a drought. And the only food got from the branches. So the giraffe stretched its neck for weeks at a time, many years, to try to increase the food, and his neck got stretched. And this happened over several generations. And the offspring, and therefore the offspring of the giraffe had a longer neck than it would have had otherwise. And this offspring had to stretch its neck. And that was another time all animals don't have long necks. So eventually, over thousands of years of this, hundreds of thousands of years, gradually giraffes had long necks because their parents and grandparents and their predecessors, their ancestors, had to stress the necks.
How
does that
quieten
up?
Don't be smart.
Doesn't it happen when, like, the people drop skin? Doesn't it happen?
Well, the marketing. Here's the thing, the marketing is we're still in the textbooks in subtle forms. It's really stupid. Evolution has never been able to let go of the market, is what Jan Hansen takes place with. You know, if you lay out in the sun, spend your life handling on your rear beach and all your life, your kids will tend to have darker skins. Cut off mouse tails, and then if you have offspring with shorter tails, if you cut it off in a generation, if you cut it off the tails, and allow the children to control the climate, and very soon you have mice without tails. What's wrong with that? Simply not true. Acquired characteristics are not transmittable. It is the texture of skin, the shade of skin that your children are going to have, is determined the moment they are conceived, and it's determined by what? The mixture of your genes and your mate's genes, and which ones become dominant. And if that mixture is going to produce a child with a certain shade of skin, you can tan yourself or bleach yourself to your heart's content and don't change one of them. You did all your life and married them at 50. You don't change anything. We all know that side of the place.
What do the evolution
people want to make? Well, the consensus is that we've stopped with alien.
Well, really?
We may lose our appendix from that other way. Vestigial organ. Now we're down to two, I think. Now we're going to run out of vestigial organs. Let's see the history of this. So, the only explanation they had was Lamarckianism, the transmission of acquired characteristics. Now, when Darwin did his work, whereas Darwinism, the mechanism which came to be called natural selection, whereas it was accepted in economics, what came to be psychology, sociology, all the other areas, social sciences, Herbert Spencer, William Graham Sumner, and all these things. It was rejected by the biologists. What did the biologists do? Did they go back to creation? No, they went back to Lamarck. So for the next 50 years or so, Origin of Species came out, 1849 to 1851. You see, that's the middle of the 19th century, between then and the turn of the century, the biologists were either Lamarckian or agnostic in terms of method. It was sort of a mixture of Lamarckianism and agnosticism. That is, some went back to Lamarck and used say what he said was, yes, Darwinism applies, but you get these new forms by the transmission of acquired characteristics. Most of them just said we don't know, or many of them. But they did not accept Darwinism. Now, what changed all that? Well, we'll see when we get the next. The change was the work of Mendel, Gregor Mendel. Although Mendel's work had been done in Darwin's time, had not been noticed. The implications of it had not been noticed. The idea of limitation.
I'll let you read this. That's true. When I get home on that, I'll be able to find where it's not out. That's the Bible.
The laws of nature. Or Lord.